Musings about electric vehicles. By Worthing Gooner. My Citroën C3 will be 3 years old in January, and knowing that in the past I have often changed my car, then a friend asked me if I had considered going electric. Several years ago I had briefly thought about it but quickly dismissed the idea. At that time I was commuting 90 miles a day, 45 miles each way, and unless I acquired a very expensive model, nothing could guarantee me the range on a cold, wet day. But now, years later, I am retired and supposedly electric vehicles have improved, so could one be feasible for me? I decided that I would investigate the possibility. This is what I discovered. The government and many MPs have been suckered into the whole climate change scam. They have committed the country to make huge reductions in so-called greenhouse gases with little thought about the costs to the country, both in jobs and financially. One of their flagship policies is to force us into electric vehicles, EVs, instead of the internal combustion engine, ICE, vehicles we currently use. On the face of it, if the adverts for them are to be believed, EVs are wonderful, but is this true? How has this policy on EVs come about? Under the Miliband Climate Change Act, the government is legally obliged to take up the predictions of the Climate Change Committee for planning anything to do with energy usage, and ICEs use a lot of energy and produce lots of nasty CO2, so we're an obvious target for the CCC. So firstly, EL looked at its prediction on electric vehicle numbers. The CCC say 35% of 2025 new domestic car sales will be EVs, but what is this in actual numbers? One thing I do know is that in 2016, when this prediction was made, new car sales for the year were about 2.7 million, but today car sales are, for a number of reasons, falling. Last year's total sales dropped to 2.4 million and this year is on course to be lower still. But the government accepted the 2016 numbers, so I did the same. If we take 35% of 2.7 million, this means that the motor manufacturers are expected to make 945,000 EV sales in 2025. This is the number I worked with, even though it is highly unlikely to be reached considering that the sales are for all types alternatively fueled vehicles, AFV, were only 59,911 in 2018. The government really wants us to purchase pure electric vehicles, rechargeable battery cars, and has messed around with subsidies to try to encourage their purchase. More of this later. However, sales of plug-in hybrids, PHEV, and hybrid petrol electric cars actually make up the vast proportion of AFV sales. FEVs are similar to pure EVs but have a small petrol or diesel engine to recharge the batteries as they are being driven, as an addition to mains recharging. The engine in a FEV cannot be used to propel the car. Petrol hybrids have a larger petrol engine capable of propelling the car, as well as smaller battery capability, with a limited electric range of about 30 miles and a petrol range similar to an ICE car. Diesel hybrids are available but are so far out of favor that they sold zero in May and only seven in the year to date. In April 2019, AFV sales accounted for just 6.4% of total car sales, with petrol hybrids accounting for 4.2%, FEVs 1.2%, and EVs the rest. Not good news for the government, as the public appear to not want pure EVs, but hardly surprising given their limitations. It is interesting to note that many purchasers of petrol hybrids rarely use them in electric mode, making them an expensive way to buy a new car. Next, I had a look at capabilities of pure EVs. The average mileage for cars in the UK has fallen since the 2008 economic crash, but is now climbing again and is about 7,900 miles a year, from Rack Foundation, or 21.64 miles per day, which would probably suit me. Looking at the Nissan Leaf, as I could find real-life numbers for it and it is a roughly similar size to my C3, this would indicate that an average car would need to be fully recharged at least every 3 days. More likely every other day when you take into account Nissan's strange recommendation that you should not regularly exceed 80% charge. However, this is average use and many users will need to recharge their EV at least once a day. Although many cars are often used for short runs, such as taking the kids to school, to go shopping or a short commute for which an EV may be ideal, we all need to make the occasional longer run and I am no exception. That weekend away, a visit to relatives at the other end of the country, a business trip, not for me, or a couple of weeks away on holiday will all require a much greater range. Most ICEs can go around 300 miles before needing to be refueled, filling stations are plentiful and your car can be filled in under 5 minutes. Compare this to an EV. Few have a nominal range over 200 miles on a full charge. Public recharging points are few and far between and even on a fast high-voltage charger it's often claimed you will need about 20 minutes to get up to 80% charged. Don't forget that any electrical use in an EV reduces its range so you may have to limit use of the heater, wipers, radio, heated seats and heated rear window to make it to the next charging point. When you get to your destination will you be able to recharge your EV? A recent survey found that many people were resorting to using multiple extension leads plugged into a standard domestic supply. Not only is this a very slow way to charge an EV, it is downright dangerous running a live cable across the pavement in the rain. Yes, range could be a major problem, so I dug a little deeper. A standard Nissan Leaf is rated at 110 kW and has a stated range of 168 miles on a full charge. Now I could opt for a better model rated at 168 kW and the range goes up to 239 miles, but what does this go to charging time? When I looked I could hardly believe what I was reading, a full charge from a domestic socket would take 32 hours. Yes, a day and a third. To get anything like a quick charge I would need to purchase a 50 kW fast charger, about £900 plus installation plus cable, and then a charge from 20% to 80% would take 90 minutes. Well, my trip to the shops would be okay, but I reckon a trip to visit the relatives in North Yorkshire would require two extra 90-minute stops if I could find a 50 kW charger when I needed it. I started to realize why EV sales are so sluggish and why most AFV buyers are opting for hybrids. Logically, sales of AFVs are not going to jump straight to the 2025 target of 945,000 EVs a year. They are going to have built up to the. In the 9 years from 2016 to 2025, let's imagine sales increasing by 100,000 a year. Cumulative sales would then be 4.5 million, 100,000 plus 200,000 plus 300,000. Using these numbers we should already have a national EV fleet of 600,000 AFVs, but it is actually only just over 200,000. The projected total is not unreasonable if we are to meet the government target, as the current UK fleet is about 38 million cars and vans, but we are clearly failing to get anywhere near it. However, this is even worse than it looks, as there were already over 50,000 AFV registrations at the end of 2015. Annual AFV sales are accelerating, but very, very slowly, and are nowhere near hitting the numbers necessary to meet the CCC's predictions. I then considered if I would be able to charge a new EV anywhere other at home. I must also consider that in 2025 the capacity of many of those cars' batteries will have deteriorated with age. Nissan predict 3% per year, and a life of perhaps 8 years. Taking this into consideration, it is not unreasonable to expect half the 4.5 million electric vehicles projected to be on the road in 2025 will need a full charge every day. This gives a reasonable number of 2.25 million needing to be charged daily in 2025, for which recharging facilities need to be provided. Currently there are about 13,600 public charging points in the UK for the 200,000 EVs on the road, but this number is going to have to increase hugely if we are going to have 4.5 million EVs by 2025. Plainly, a huge investment will need to be made in grid infrastructure to support the required network of fast chargers, but there is no sign of it happening. Why? Have the PTB realized that we are never going to reach sales of 945,000 EVs by 2025? I mentioned earlier that Nissan reckons an 8-year battery life, so I looked at how much a replacement would cost. It appears to be about £5,500, so if I was to change a car after 3 years it wouldn't be my problem, but I suspect it could affect the second-hand price. The other problem is the weight of the battery. My C3 has a curb weight of 1,090 kg, a Leaf weighs in at roughly double that, 2,149 kg. My C3 has a heavy engine and transmission, the Leaf has an electric motor. The main difference must be the weight of the battery. It must take a lot of power to drag around at least a ton of battery. Electric vehicles rely heavily on lithium-ion batteries, and there are plenty of questions regarding their green credentials, so I suppose I should consider them as part of my investigation. But as someone who is not convinced by climate change, my thinking was not unduly influenced by this. Firstly, the question of rare earth minerals. Lithium-ion batteries make use of lithium, cobalt, nickel and other metals, and the production of much of them has been associated with poor human rights and worker protection in third world countries, many in Chinese-owned facilities. On the other hand, these same materials are used in modern electronics, and as nearly everyone has a mobile phone, people seem not to worry about this aspect, so should I? A little more worrying is that, as the name implies, rare earth minerals are rare, and there are major worries that there will not be enough available to meet the enormous demands imposed by a mass switch to EVs. This is not a problem today, but will need to be kept under review. In the short term, however, I note that the Chinese, who have collared much of the REM supply market, have recently been threatening to stop exports as part of the trade war with the US. Now, this could be a huge problem, as I have a possible January date for a car. Will one be available then if the Chinese threat materializes? One other thing to think about is used battery disposal. It shouldn't worry me if I dispose of an EV before it needs replacing, but I can see a future government introducing a tax here. Could this happen before next January? Having considered the availability of charging points, I now needed to think about electricity. What if in 2025 we have all done the government's bidding and purchased an EV? I now needed to look at if there would be plenty of generating capacity to cope with the additional load coming from the need to charge 2.25 million EVs daily. Some basic facts: the UK will have a stated electricity capacity to supply a maximum of 98 gigawatts this winter, according to national grid projections. This includes every source: interconnectors, biomass, pump storage, CCGT, coal, wind, solar, and anything else you can think of. But this is clearly rubbish, as the calculations includes 11 gigawatts of coal, 43 gigawatts of renewables, and 3 gigawatts of storage. Let's deal with these in turn. Coal capacity is falling quicker than predicted because it is not getting supply contracts, so it looks like being down to about 4 gigawatts. Renewables are highly intermittent. Solar is only available in daylight and capacity drops off during the winter, and wind at best produces 38% of its plated capacity in winter but only 20% in summer. At the time of writing, June 2019, the UK has 21.7 gigawatts of installed wind power. Are we seriously going to double this by the end of the year? I nearly forgot storage. At the moment, this is basically pump storage, which has the capacity to supply 36 gigawatts for about 45 minutes, so it is only useful for smoothing unexpected peak demands. The grid predicts, providing the winter is no colder than last year, peak demand will be 48 gigawatts in the week before Christmas, meaning that with any luck we will just about scrape through without power cuts. By 2025, the country will have closed down any remaining coal-fired power stations to meet emissions targets. In addition, we are scheduled to close 5 life-expired advanced gas-cooled reactor stations before then, removing another 5.06 gigawatts of capacity. The last 3 AGRs are to close by 2030, removing another 3.6 GWS. What generating capacity is going to be added by 2025? Well, Hinkley C is supposed to bring 3.2 gigawatts to the party in 2025. However, this is a new design, and the 4 others of the same design that are currently under construction are all running years late. One is currently 10 years late, another 7 years late, and the remaining 2 in China are both 4 years late. This is not to say that it will not be ready by 2025, but it looks ominous. Other new nuclear projects all seem to have died or stalled, and there is no chance of any other new nuclear station before 2025. There is one CCGT in Manchester, which should be online by then, but this is only 0.8 gigawatts, and Lynemouth PS will have been converted to biomass, adding 0.42 gigawatts. 3.8 gigawatts of offshore wind is under construction, but this is the plate capacity and can only be expected to add about 25% of that to the grid, 0.95 gigawatts. There isn't any tidal power under construction in the UK. That project was scrapped due to its outrageous cost. Totaling this up, the national grid says we are going to have 111 gigawatts available in 2025, which on the face of it shows a slightly improved situation over the current situation. However, this is heavily reliant on Hinkley being built to program, 9 gigawatts of renewables and 14 gigawatts of interconnectors being added, of which there is no sign at present. The official prediction even includes 1 gigawatt of extra storage capacity and 1 gigawatt of extra oil-fired capacity. I assume the oil is lots of small diesel generators, and the extra storage is coming from battery farms that can only supply power for a very short term. Importantly, these predictions takes no account of any growth in usage. Domestic use is sure to rise as the government wants us all to use less gas and move to electricity for heating and cooking. Several railway lines are going to be using more power. Crossrail, Thames Link, Great Western Main Line, Midland Main Line and Northern Hub are all examples. HS2 is due in 2026, so just misses out being counted. This clearly shows that rather than there being plenty of power, even without adding 2.25 million Fs into the mix, supply is hardly enough today, let alone in 2025. If we start getting blackouts or even brownouts, it is going to make people think twice about buying an F that they can't drive because they can't charge it. Do I really want a car sitting on my drive that is little more than an expensive ornament? All this, and I haven't yet looked at the question of vehicle costs. First, I looked at running costs, and here an F is attractive as there is no road tax or fuel tax to pay. Recent calculations in a green car magazine showed that but for the tax and VAT on petrol, it would be cheaper to run an ICE. It is worth pointing out that the government will not put up with a drop in revenue if ICE sales drop or AFV sales increase. In fact, the government has already trimmed F subsidies to £3,500 for a pure F and removed them completely for other car categories, although a £500 grant towards a home charger is still available, but due for review next year. At the moment, Fs are exempt from vehicle tax and congestion charges, but how long will that last? If it can be shown that ICE car sales numbers are falling substantially and F numbers are increasing, how long will be before they are taxed to make up any shortfall? Subsidies have already been reduced, how long before they are ended completely? Unlike petrol, there is no special electricity tax for road users. Fuel duty raised £27.6 billion last year, and the government can't afford to lose that kind of money, so a scheme will have to be developed to tax the electricity used to recharge cars. We also have to consider the plight of the SME who finds that he is having to pay to enter the ultra-low emissions zone in London in his 5-year-old van. £12.50 a day on top of the £11.50 a day congestion charge soon adds up. I have heard many a plumber or courier complaining that they cannot afford to buy an electric van, and even if they could, there are none on the market that can carry the equivalent load to a diesel van. There is a Transport for London scheme of grants if you scrap a diesel van, but I understand that it offers a low sum and is tied up in so much red tape that many London SMEs find it next to useless. If you don't live in London, don't think you are getting away with having an old van. ULEZ schemes are due to be rolled out in a number of UK towns and cities over the next couple of years. Insurance is also worth looking at, but a little more difficult to compare as it is very much down to the individual's driving record. My C3 is fairly cheap for me to insure, but a full no-claims bonus makes a huge contribution. However, I like my creature comforts in a car, so I want lots of extras, meaning I do not go for the cheapest in the model range. My C3 is Insurance Group 11. To get a similarly specified car, I had to look at the Leaf Techna, and this is Insurance Group 26. All AFVs are more expensive to purchase than an equivalent petrol car by between 2 and 3 times, even after the government grant has been taken into consideration. I decided to use CarWow to compare purchase costs, as their prices include discounts. My model C3 currently comes in at around £16,500, and a Leaf Techno is priced at £34,340, including the government grant of £3,500. At the moment, it would seem that a home charger is essential due to the low number of public chargers, so you can add another £1,000 to that. But if you want a truly fast charger, you will need to pay out a lot more, as a three-phase supply is needed. The Leaf is a pure F, FEFs and petrol hybrids are still more expensive due to the need to include a petrol engine and not being eligible for a government grant. The question is, am I going to pay out over £18,000 in running costs over 3 years of ownership of an ICE to make an F a viable option? Another thought: the main driver for FEFs is so-called climate change and the restrictions placed on CO2 emissions by the Climate Change Act. Brexit could well lead to a rethink once free from the EU's climate legislation and the costs and lack of uncompetitiveness become apparent. The Act is already forcing up electricity prices to the detriment of steel and glass makers. Recent figures show the EU greenhouse gas emissions have not decreased for several years, and bit for other UK's reductions would have increased for the past 3 years. Will EVs still sell if they have to compete on a level playing field? So what is my conclusion? I cannot see me buying a pure EV. They don't have the range, there is insufficient support infrastructure, and they are far too expensive. In the future, I might consider a FEF as they get over the range and infrastructure problems, but they are far too expensive at the moment. I just can't see the point of a petrol hybrid. They are an expensive way to buy an ICE car. At the moment, I will stick with a normal ICE car if I choose to replace my C3 next January, but I will keep the situation under review. Who knows, there might be a breakthrough in battery technology, a new cheap F on the market, or a huge government incentive to encourage us to buy an F. Copyright Worthing Gooner 2019.